Hey, our main speaker tonight is Donna from Rancho Mirage.
Hi, everybody. I'm Donna Egan. I'm an alcoholic. This is real. I am really excited to be here tonight. Everybody's been asking me if I'm nervous, and I don't know why I'm not, though. This is probably one of the first times I've really felt at home coming into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting where I don't know most everybody. I do know a few people here tonight, though. And it just feels really good to be here. It feels, it's an honor for me to be able to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous like this. And there's so many people in this room that I admire a lot. And that's that even makes it more, you know, more special to me. Frank H. always says that he's happy. He's glad to know that he's an alcoholic. And my first sponsor always said that. Her name was Phyllis Cowman, and she's no longer alive. And she used to say, "My name is Phyllis, and I'm grateful to know that I'm an alcoholic." And the first time I ever heard that was from her. And I always feel a real connection whenever I hear Frank say that. Red, I've heard Red speak a lot of times, and it's just really nice to be here tonight. A lady that from this area, I think, Sharon B., was down at our Friday night meeting last week, and she asked me to specifically say hello to you all from her and to Polly. And she told a lot of my story. She and I have a whole lot in common. She talked about, like, being in communes and doing where you do everything the hard way, you know, grinding the wheat berries and breaking down baking the bread. And I did that, only I kind of did it on a smaller scale. Well, I was in a religious commune, but then I did the whole thing like on my own, where I used to split all my wood in the kitchen, and, I could smoke pot in there, and nobody could see what I was doing. And I also ran with the carnival for a couple of years like she did, but I took 5 kids with me when I went, so I had to tell her about that. I'm really grateful to be here tonight. I already said that. I want to try to tell you a little bit about what it used to be like and what happened and what it's like now. Now I'm nervous. let's see. Well, I grew up in Montana, in the country. I don't even have a high school education. You know, I've heard a lot of speakers who get up at the podium and they talk about these tremendous achievements that they've made in their lives. And I've met a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that just impressed me so much because they did so much stuff, you know. Before I got here, my greatest achievement was I won a second place in a chili cook-off at a place called the Bear Creek Saloon in just outside of Red Lodge, Montana. And it was fun, you know. I don't remember it very well, but I did get, you know, I did do that. And let's see, I grew up in a family that, we had alcoholism in our family. My whole family was, it's a little bit of a different twist because in the beginning, for the first about 12 or 13 years of my life, my parents, neither one of them drank at all. My mother was 14 when she married my dad, and they both ran away to escape an alcoholic home. And they were absolutely determined that they would never be like them, and so they didn't drink. But like a tape that I heard of Polly's said that she said that her dad was the same way, but that he, though he didn't drink alcohol, he was extremely angry all of the time. And that was exactly the kind of home that I lived in. There was just a lot of anger, a lot of violence. A lot of stuff went on inside the house that nobody knew on the outside, you know. And I didn't really know why. I didn't understand why all this was going on. I just knew you had to be careful. Kenny, I think, was the name of the man who did the first 10-minute. Is that right? Yes. He talked about his little boy's eyes. And I've heard that called computer eyes, you know. And it's the eyes that children of alcoholics of my kind get. You know, my kids did the same thing with me, and I did the same thing with my parents. When my dad would walk in the door, I would check him out, and I could tell whether he had a good day or a bad day. You know, and if my dad had had a good day, and he was happy, and things had gone well for him, then things were going to be okay. And if he had had a bad day, or if he was afraid, or if he had lost, or if there was anything like that going on in our in him, then he could just walk past you and knock you off your feet, you know. And I wanted more than anything not to be like him, and I did end up being like him. And when I say that, you know, when I talk, I say a lot of things that I've heard here, because when I came here, I just knew I had all these things going on, but I didn't know how to put words to them. And I have heard a lot of speakers who have told me what my history is about, and that's the stuff that I use. I don't pretend that any of this is mine. All of this stuff, all of the things that I say and my experiences are what I have heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, what people have taught me about my life and my disease. And anyway, growing up in that household was really, there was a lot of violence and a lot of terror and a lot of fear. And I don't know where I got the idea that there was something wrong with me and that that's why all this was going on. But I did decide that if there was just some way I could be good enough, you know, if I could just find some way that I could do this right, that they would love me and that maybe I would be safe. And, you know, the kind of stuff that went on in my household is all of the garden variety types of abuse that everybody hears about today. The kind of things that people go to jail for. Only where I came from, they didn't do anything about it then. They just closed the curtains and they pretended that they didn't know. And when I was 17, my dad got caught for some of the stuff that he was doing and was facing a prison sentence, and we left town in the middle of the night, you know. And at 17, I quit school because they didn't want me going back to school. They were afraid that somebody else would find out. So what I'm trying to tell you is that for a long time, I thought that that was why I was an alcoholic, and I absolutely was sure that that was why I didn't have any success in my life, was because I'd had such a horrible background, and my parents were so terrible. But that doesn't have anything to do with why I'm an alcoholic, but the point I'm trying to make by telling you that is that that I had a life that did not work from the beginning. I mean, from the beginning, that I didn't know anything about success. I didn't know anything about feeling good. I knew a lot about being afraid, and I knew a lot about failure, and I knew a lot about shame. And I didn't know, you know, I absolutely had no coping skills whatsoever. When I was 17 years old, I had never been to a baseball game or a dance or a football game or any of that other stuff that all my friends did. I stayed home and raised my little sisters, you know. So that's just the kind of life that I had. So here I am, totally set up for alcoholism. There was another speaker that came to the desert about a year or so ago named Sharon, and she said that she thought that she was an alcoholic from the day she was born. And the reason she thought that was because she said, when you put alcohol in me, it's like putting electricity to wiring that's already been laid. You know what I mean? I was completely set up for alcoholism before I ever added alcohol to me. And my parents were the same way. I said that they didn't drink for quite a while. My dad was probably in his early 30s before he picked up a drink. And the minute he started to drink, within 3 months he was drinking, you know, a fifth a day plus whatever else he could get, and he was going bankrupt, and he was beating his wife and beating his kids, and all this stuff was crazy, insane stuff was going on, and it was like the electric circuit was completed, you know. I was an alcoholic from the go. I had absolutely no coping skills. I had no way to deal with life. I was a failure and a loser my whole life. That's just the way it was. And it's not like that today. You know, that's the really good news. I have a chance to have a life today, and I do have a life today, and it's because of Alcoholics Anonymous and because of my sobriety and my higher power. I also determined as a young person that I did not want to be like them, and I didn't drink for a real long time. I married a guy and he didn't drink, and we had five kids in 6 years and 3 months. And I was 26 years old, and I had five children, and I was scared to death. And I didn't have the slightest idea what to do with those kids. I didn't know anything about it. All I knew was what I had seen. And that was not good. You know, the stuff that happened in my household, I didn't want repeated for my kids. But I didn't really have any, you know, thing to draw from. You know, kids grow up in situations and they pretty much pick up what they see. There's a story that I always tell that is a perfect picture of what my coping skills were about. As a kid growing up, my mom always bought eggs from the guy that lived in the country. We lived in the country too, but he lived farther out in the country. And so she didn't throw away the egg cartons. She'd put them on top of the refrigerator when they were empty. And when we had 6 or 8 of them or whatever, she'd go get eggs. Well, all I knew was that you didn't throw them away, you put them on top of the refrigerator. Well, I never questioned it. I absolutely didn't question it, just like I didn't question anything else I saw them do. They were the grown-ups. I figured that's what I was supposed to do. I got married to a guy, and we were living in South Carolina, and we'd been married about 6 months, and I had this big old stack of egg cartons on top of the fridge. And he said to me one day, "Hey, you know, what are you saving these for?" And I just said, I don't know. That's where they go, you know? That's where they're supposed to be. I didn't know. And that is just a classic story of what my coping skills were about. That's about how much I knew, you know? I went through that marriage trying as best as I could, you know, saving egg cartons, trying to be a wife and trying to be a mother to those kids. And and I was absolutely insane. And I hadn't found anything to make my life work for me. I don't know why I hadn't found alcohol. I just didn't. Part of it was that I didn't want to be like my dad. And the other part of it was it just really wasn't a part of our life. We were busy, you know. I was, I guess the most exciting thing I did for a long time was put M&Ms in chocolate chip cookies, you know. Anyway, what happened is that when I was about 27 years old, my husband had an affair with my girlfriend, and I had these 5 little kids. The oldest one was 6, the youngest one was 9 months old, and I'll tell you what, I was really, really tired of being good. I had been trying that whole time. I figured if I could find some way to please God and if I could be good enough. And I did a lot of church. I had, you know, I think I'd been a spiritual seeker all my life. I remember my first spiritual awakening. I was 7 years old. I remember it absolutely. I remember standing in the backyard one day and looking around and thinking, why is all this here? Like, what? Why are we here? What is this for? What does this mean? And that was about the most I knew to ask then. But, you know, when I think back at that, I know that I was looking for an answer. I was a person who needed a spiritual answer way back then. And, when I found alcohol, when I was 27, I divorced the kid's dad, and I started working, and I went to work in the bars, and I discovered alcohol and drugs. And I'll tell you what, when I found alcohol, I mean, the first few times I drank it, it just made me violently ill. You know, alcohol works on me like the beating of a club. It's just, it's not good. I just threw up a lot. I cried a lot. It was terrible. I had blackouts from the very beginning. The first time I ever picked up a drink, I was in a blackout after, you know, drinking however many. But the thing about it that I remember is that I found a power greater than myself that made my life work. That was the first higher power that I had, was alcohol. That was the first thing I had ever found that made that fear go away. There was a guy that spoke at our Palm Springs convention last year named Frank M. from Chicago, and he said that they have a beginner's meeting that they started at their meeting, and they invited everybody with under a year to come into this meeting, and they pretty much very carefully and very explicitly go over the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with these people. And he said, he talks about accessory AA, and he said they really kind of avoid all that. There's a lot of stuff that's come into our program that really isn't in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, a lot of things like, for example, take what you want and leave the rest. You know, that's not in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is like, you know, not optional. Pretty much all of those things are suggestions, but it's the word suggestions means subtle demand. So that's doesn't leave you a big opening there. And you know, easy does it, and I mean, you know, just things that that indicate that this is not as big a deal as it really is. And he said one of the things that they did in their newcomers meeting was that they asked these newcomers to describe an alcoholic. I said, you know, we come into AA and everybody talks a lot about alcoholics. Well, what's an alcoholic? You tell me. What's an alcoholic? And he said, they started describing to him what they would add, what they would put into this invisible test tube if they were going to make an alcoholic. And they put in fear, and they put in anger, and guilt, and shame, and self-loathing, and you know, lots and lots of fear, lots and lots of guilt. Over and over again, they mentioned that, and a bunch of descriptives like that. You know, I'm sure you guys can think of a few. Fill in the blanks. And but the thing that they didn't add was alcohol. And the interesting fact with that is that what happens when you do add alcohol to the fear and the self-loathing and the guilt and the shame and the remorse is that it appears to make those feelings go away. Alcohol appears to make them go away. Like, I know that when I put alcohol in me, I didn't have the fear that I had had before. I just didn't feel that fear, and I certainly didn't feel the self-loathing. I thought I was pretty cool, you know. I could go into a room full of people, and I could talk and dance and party with the best of them, and I didn't have that fear. I didn't have that shame. You know, I had a friend I used to drink with when I started drinking who used to say, let's get drunk and be somebody. And I would say, let's get drunk and be somebody else. You know, and that's exactly what I was looking for in alcohol, and that's what I got, actually. Because when I put alcohol in me, I didn't have to be that scared little kid anymore. I didn't have to walk around knowing that I had all those secrets of things that happened in my home that I didn't want you to know about. And I didn't have, see, I was ashamed that I'd never been to a football game. And when I'm in groups of friends and I hear them talk about dating experiences and I hear them talk about, you know, going to the county fair, I mean, even just silly crap like that, you know, even occasionally will get those feelings like, you don't want to know what happened in my home. You know, you can't just talk about this stuff on a social level, you know. People don't want to hear about this. This is real downer, you know, thing. So that was one of the big setups for me to feel like I was different than the rest. And I also think that it's neat. Frank M. also mentions that there's one more aspect to this thing of adding alcohol to all of these ingredients that we carry around with us. And that is that after a point, not only does it not make the fear go away, it intensifies the fear. It heightens those feelings of self-loathing and the depression and the anger and the remorse, all those things, you know. And I remember very much when I heard this tape identifying so much with that, that's exactly what it was like for me. It was like there was no escape, you know. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time in February of 1981. And I still had the kids. I was in trouble with my drinking. I guess I'd been drinking maybe not long, 5 or 6 years, but I was in real trouble with my drinking. And, you know, alcohol was definitely not doing me any good. And I came into my first AA meeting in Red Lodge, Montana, where there were about probably maybe 6 people belonged to that group, and they had 2 meetings a week. And I couldn't tell you what they told me. I do remember that it was a lot of, you know, gray tunnel sobriety kind of a thing, you know, where you just put the plug in the jug and you just don't drink no matter what, and, you know, too bad about the way you feel. You know, I remember this, there was this big, tall, skinny guy, always wore black, had a big old wad of Copenhagen in his lip all the time. And he always said, you know, that he was like the tomcat making love to the skunk, that he hadn't had all he wanted, he had all he could stand, you know. I remember coming in there after repeatedly, you know, trying to get sober, and I just couldn't do it. See, I made a big mistake when I came into AA, and people told me that sober was better. People said to me, you know, yeah, we just don't drink here one day at a time, and life gets better, and you'll be amazed. And what happened for me was when I didn't use alcohol, I didn't have my higher power. See, alcohol was the only thing that had ever made my life work. It was the only thing that had ever allowed me to be anybody but who I was. And it was the only thing that had ever given me relief from all those secrets and all those fears, ever. And I'm grateful that I found alcohol, to tell you the truth, because I probably would have killed myself if I hadn't. In fact, up until when I was 27, when I started drinking, about every 6 months I was on the phone to suicide prevention, you know, or whoever would listen, because I couldn't bear it. I could not bear the way I felt. And so when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and tried not to drink, it didn't feel good, you know. And if there's a, if the, you know, if there's any new people here tonight who are in the early part of sobriety and it doesn't feel good, you know, don't make the mistake that I made and feel like that there must be something extra wrong with you or something different wrong with you, you know. I came in and I saw people that what it appeared to me to be was that they didn't drink and they looked pretty good, you know. People around here, we clean up pretty good, most of us, you know, and it looked to me like they were doing business. They were, they had lives and families, and I'll tell you what, when I stopped, when I didn't drink, all I, God, what I had was all those ingredients in this test tube, you know. I had that fear that would not go away, and the pain, and the self-loathing, and the shame, and the guilt, and all those secrets that I had to hide from. And sobriety was real painful for me. And, you know, Clancy talks about that. Clancy says that drinking is, alcohol is actually not the problem. He said alcohol is the solution. First time I ever heard him say that, I thought, now there's a guy who knows where I'm coming from, you know. He said that if alcohol was the problem, then hospitals would turn out well people. And jails would turn out well people, you know. And anytime you got alcohol away from the alcoholic, they would be okay. And he said that's not the case. He said that sobriety is what's is the really painful thing. And he said, what's wrong with us? You know, if alcohol is not the problem, then what's the problem? He said alcoholism is the problem. And Clancy's also the first person I ever heard that described it so that I could hear it. And that is that he said what alcoholism is the core knowledge that on some level I am not enough. And that, I knew exactly what that meant. I knew exactly what that felt like. There was no question in my mind. And, you know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in and out of the doors for 6.5 years. And I was as unsuccessful in sobriety as I had ever been drinking. I mean, it was a disaster. My life had never really amounted to anything. I had these 5 beautiful children. That was about the only really good thing that had happened in my life. I certainly did not appreciate them. You know, I didn't know what to do with them. They scared me to death. It wasn't that I didn't love them. It was that they terrified me. I didn't know how to do life in any form. I didn't know how to be Donna, and I sure didn't know anything about giving anything to anybody else. I was, as my drinking progressed, alcohol absolutely became the most important thing because it was the only method I had of getting through. And, you know, trying to get sober was, I didn't have a lot of success at that for a long time, you know, and I'm not really sure. You know, maybe I just wasn't finished drinking. I don't know. But I know that sobriety was extremely painful. And I know that I'm not alone in that. You know, that, that's really the typical condition of alcoholics, which I didn't know that for a long time either. What ended up happening for me is I came in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for 6.5 years. You know, sometimes I'd do 30 days. Sometimes I'd do a week. There was one time where I went to treatment, which was a real last-ditch effort for me. And behind treatment, they gave me 28 days clean and sober, and I managed to not drink or use for 13 and a half months. And I really, really thought that I probably was going to be okay, you know, if I could just get some, excuse me, if I could just get some momentum going here, you know, if I could, I thought my time was going to just carry me on. That's what I saw you guys do. You talked a lot about time, you know. Everybody always wanted to tell you how long they'd been sober, so I thought, well, that must be the goal, you know. I remember meeting Terry Egan, and he asked me how long I was sober, and I said 13 and a half months, and he looked at me and said, you know, this ain't no goddamn marathon. And I thought, well, what did you ask me for then? Not like I totally didn't get it, you know. I really believed that the time sober that I had was going to make a difference, and that you know, it doesn't make any difference. I continued to get more and more beat up by alcohol, and my disease became worse and worse. And the last time I came in the rooms, I had made a geographic. I was living over in Kona, Hawaii. And when I went over there, I was sober about 8 months maybe, and I stayed sober over there the rest of that 13 and a half months, and then I got drunk again. And when I got drunk that time, I thought, this is it. I didn't believe in anything or anybody. I honestly did not believe there was any hope for me at all. I saw other people doing it. They kept telling me sober was better. It didn't feel better to me. It felt a whole lot worse. And I really did not, I thought, just like I had always thought, yeah, life is for you, but it's never going to work for me. It never had. And, you know, That last time I got drunk, I ended up getting drunk about 4 or 5 times over the next 6 months before I finally got sober for the last time, and that was the 5th of May, 1987. And what happened for me is, it's a miracle. It's an absolute miracle. You know, what's really weird is that I've been sober this long before I realize how much of a miracle it is. It's been about the last 6 months I can hardly even think about the idea that I really, honest to God, am sober today, that I just want to cry. I can't even believe this has happened. I am a loser right down the line, always have been, have experienced no success in my life. And for me to be here tonight at this meeting with you, it just blows me away what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. I came in the last time and I met this wonderful woman, Phyllis Kalman. And she was my Eskimo. This lady saved my life. And she just gathered me up. You know, she really gathered me up. She was somebody who walked and talked and ate and slept and breathed Alcoholics Anonymous. There wasn't any part of her life that was separate from the program. And the love that she had just kind of oozed out. And you had to fight to get a seat next to her. People, at the end of the meeting, it would be a cluster around this woman, and you had to wait in line, you know. And I gladly waited in line to be around her. I ended up spending about a month with her. She was over there just after her husband had died. And I got to spend a lot of that time with her, and we went to the beach a lot, and we talked a lot, and she shared her experiences with me about her life, and like before alcohol, also during alcohol, and then also in sobriety. She was, I think she was 28 or 29 years sober. And man, I would have done anything for this woman. She showed me the first thing I'd ever seen for unconditional love. And she was, you know, God sent her to me. And I don't know what would have happened to me if it wasn't for her. And there's been a few of those people, you know. We always do get what we need. She helped me tremendously. She told me things that I have modeled my sobriety after today. You know, of course, there's no way that she could have told me, you know, everything I needed to know in a month, but I sure have hung on to what she did give to me, and it's a precious gift, and I think about her all the time. I was listening to her tape yesterday from the Honolulu Convention. I mean, I just really, this woman was unbelievable. But at any rate, what happened is that she died in the first year of my sobriety. I was about 10 months sober, I guess, when she died. But before she died, she went back, came back to the mainland, and I wrote her a letter and said, well, I drank one more time, and that was going to be my last drink. And she wrote me a letter, and she said, do me a favor, honey. She said, I want you to get out your big book and read the last 3 paragraphs in the chapter Freedom from Bondage. And she said, do that every night for 2 weeks, and if you miss a night, you have to start over. And that was the only part that she added that isn't in there. But I just did it because I just loved her so much. And she said, now, this is what I want you to do. She said, I want you to put this piece of paper with these people's name in this book, and I want you to open it every night, read that out loud, and then I want you to say, God, I'm going to try to do this resentment thing like they told me to do in AA. And I want you to, and the first person on my list was my dad. I said, tonight I'm going to pray for my dad, and I'm asking you to give him a quiet heart and peace of mind, every form of security, and lots of love in his life. And I went over the list. Well, I called her and said, there's just one problem. I don't have any resentments. She said, that's okay. She said, that's all right. She just totally didn't even phase her, you know. She said, just think back, you know, to any that you may have ever had, and those will work. Do those. So I did. And, you know, I was busy working this resentment thing, and I did it for 14 days. And on the 15th day, I went to the post office, and there was a letter there from my dad. Now, see, this is a big deal, because my dad has never in his life written a letter, and he has never written one since. And it was awesome. It was a miracle that was like, you know, a special gift that God gave me. I opened up this letter, and it has just occurred to me that what he said is that I have come to a place in my life where I cannot back up and I cannot go forward. And he said, though I have always been weak, I've expected my kids to be strong, and it's occurred to me that I'd never told you that I love you and I care about you and I'm proud to be your dad. And it just, it felt like it just gutted me, you know. It just felt like it opened me up like a knife. And I must have cried for hours after that. I couldn't believe, like, why does this hurt so bad? This is the thing I've been waiting for all my life. Why does this hurt so bad? But when I settled down, the thing that I did know was that I had done this thing that Alcoholics Anonymous had asked me to do. And this was the result that I got. So just maybe this program was going to work for me after all. I was about maybe 30, 45 days sober then. I was still pretty angry, and I was going to meetings, and I was chewing people out, and I was yelling at them about their happy horse shit sobriety, don't give me that stuff, and, you know, you people make me sick, and they just kept telling me to keep coming back. And finally, after the meeting one night, I said to this guy, you know, I don't know why this program won't work for me, but it just won't work. And he said, well, how long has it been since you've had a drink? I said, 45 days. He said, well, what makes you think it's not working? And I said, because I hate this. This is lousy, you know. I mean, this hurts. This is really painful to me. And he opened up the 12 and 12 in the seventh, on the seventh step. I think it's like page 56. Anyway, I don't know what page it is. But it says, in every case, pain is the price of admission into a new life. And he said, look here, it doesn't say like most of the time, or we often found, or for most of us it seemed. He said, it says, in every case, pain had been the price of admission into a new life. So that happened to me right away. And I don't know, just like right after that, things started getting a whole lot better. And things didn't get better. That's not actually true. I was still in this, you know, living in a cockroach hotel. I had no money. I had no kids. My kids were gone. They'd been taken away from me. No family around. It was, you know, pretty glum. But I started getting better. I started getting some kind of peace. Phyllis also told me how to pray. She asked me about the God of my understanding, and I told her the God that I believed in, this God in church that I'd been taught. And she said that God was too small for my needs. And I thought, you know, that was a bad thing to say. I thought we're going to get struck with lightning here if you say that, you know. But she said, and she says that on that tape I've got, she said, I think if I were to understand God, that he would be too small for my needs. And she said, you know, do this. She said, get down on your knees tonight when you're alone and say something like this. Say, God, I don't know who you are or what you are. And I don't even really know what you want from me. But if you want anything to do with what's left of the rest of my life, then come on, because I don't know where to go from here. And I did that. And my life has started getting better from that point. And the other, you know, I did not just stroll right into happy, joyous, and free sobriety. I kicked and fought and screamed all the way. I argued with everybody. Terry and I got together in the first year of my sobriety, and we got married after I was about a year and a half sober. And he told me that for the longest time, people would say to me, you know, well, why don't you try this? And they would lay out something for me to do, and then I would tell them how it wasn't going to work and how my case was different. And he said, and then when nobody was looking, you would try it, you know? And that's kind of what I did. I really tested this thing out. There's a story about an old-timer who had to fly in an airplane for the very first time. And he was scared to death. He did not want to fly in this airplane. And so when his family met him at the other end of the trip, he got off the airplane and they said, well, you know, was it as bad as you thought it was going to be? And he said, well, no, it wasn't too bad. He said, but I never did put my full weight down. And that's the way I was with this program. You know, like, I've got a lot of choice, right? I've got nowhere else to go. This is the last house on the block. It's all over, but I still don't trust it, you know? Little by little, I started getting drawn into this program. And I've had tremendous examples ahead of, I mean, you know, to do this with me. And I have had women work the steps with me. And I've had people explain to me how important service is. And I got very busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've spent, you know, I'm a nutcase. I really identified with Kim, too. I've had to work my ass off in this program. I have had to do everything everybody told me. Once I stopped fighting, I had to do it all of it, because I was crazy. I was absolutely crazy. When you took away alcohol from me, I was crazier. I don't know, maybe, which was worse. But, you know, it just didn't happen for me like I saw other people. I did see other people in this program in just, you know, 30, 60 days, and they're cool. They've got a job, and they've seemed to have it covered. And I kept comparing my insides and their outsides, and I didn't see anybody that looked like I felt, you know, not around these rooms. And so I have done that. I've done a whole lot. And in the last year, I have learned a really important lesson, the last 2 years, that there's a great big difference between activity and action. I found that out. I found that out the hard way. One of the greatest lessons I have had in my sobriety yet was a guy that lived next door to us, and his name was Dave Anderson, and he was a member of this program, and he was a very good friend of ours. And I saw this guy every day. Every single day he was out walking around the property. He was the kind of guy who could not keep his nose out of anybody's business, so he was there constantly. I mean, he was telling me who my daughter ought to date. You know, he'd never even met my daughter, but he had an idea about the guy she was dating, you know. I mean, he was just that kind of guy. Dave was a real alcoholic. Dave was somebody just exactly like me. He came into the program, and he did try to the best of his ability to do what he was directed to do here, and it just, you know, it just, something essential was missing. And I didn't know that. Neither one of us knew that, knew really the condition that he was in for a real long time. But 2 years ago, next month, Dave committed suicide. And that has been probably the greatest lesson I've had in my sobriety yet. I'm the person who found his body. I was involved. I mean, I just couldn't believe that any of this was happening. In some weird way, I was really involved in a lot of stuff that I was just there. That's it. But I really, you know, I'm starting to believe that, though I love Dave very much, that in some way, this tragic incident, a lot of good has come from it, because he's been a really big lesson to me. What I found out is that, you know, Dave Anderson did what I did. He came into AA, and he did what they told him to do. At the time that he committed suicide, he was going to 7 a.m. meetings in Palm Desert every day. Never failed. After the meeting, he would go out to breakfast with a whole bunch of AAs. I mean, he wasn't like a leave early, you know, that kind of a thing. He was pretty involved. He was the treasurer for a Sunday morning speaker meeting in Palm Desert. I know that he had a sponsor. I know that he was trying to work the steps, and I know that he was even trying to sponsor a couple of guys. So, you know, you get this idea in here that if we do like these specific things, that this is somehow key, you know, and it is key. It has helped me tremendously to learn how to behave and be responsible and, you know, to learn how to function in a group of people. But the actual thing that my sobriety is based on is something that Dave couldn't find. And that is that, you know, it says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that the main problem with an alcoholic centers in the mind. You know, so here I am trying to go at life, and that's what Dave was doing. He was trying to solve his problems with his thinking. And he kept looking around him, and he kept seeing people in AA who looked like they were getting better and going on with their life, and he kept thinking, there must be something wrong with me that isn't wrong with them. And if you've ever sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and thought that, I'm not going to make it. I'm just not going to make it. I've sat in meetings about 3 years in a row and seen my sponsor, who has 35 years of sobriety, take cakes, you know, for 33, 34, 35, and a knot gets in my throat because I had that feeling that I wasn't going to make it. You know, and here I am, like, well, how can I feel this way? See, when I was out there drinking, I had nothing. I had zero in my life. And when you have nothing in your life and you feel lousy, you know why. But when you have everything in your life and something is wrong, you don't know why, and it's real scary. I mean, I'm married to my best friend today. I have a successful business today. I sponsor women today. I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the outside looks like it should be pretty put together. But Dave Anderson taught me a really important lesson, and that is that I need a spiritual answer. I need a spiritual answer. That same answer I was looking for when I was 7 years old is the answer that I still need tonight. And when I put that together with it, then I've got the whole picture. You know, I have a higher power today that makes my life work. And I haven't had one, you know, I didn't have a life that worked before I found booze. So this is brand new for me. I know about three or four weeks ago, Dave's wife gave us all his AA books. Well, shortly after And she gave us his 12-year medallion. I didn't tell you that. He was sober 12 years, actually. I don't even know how long before the 12 years he had begun to self-medicate. He decided, obviously, I don't feel like you guys look. I mean, it's just not working for me. Same way I thought. I don't know why this program isn't working for me, but it's just not working. And he went to a psychiatrist, but it was okay because it was a psychiatrist in the program. And this psychiatrist in the program put him on Xanax and Halcyon and Prozac. And you know, there are probably thousands of people who can take those medications and they work perfectly beautiful for those people. There are people that this is necessary for, but for Dave Anderson, it cut him off from being able to hear an answer. And I'm pretty sure that I'm just like him, you know. He was trying to fix something from the outside in because he had been trying to fix it the other way, and it didn't work. It didn't work because he didn't have a spiritual answer. So when she gave us his books, in his big book was four different kinds of fourth step inventory. And they were like from the 12 steps, but they were very, very variated a little bit. They were a little bit different. Some of them had like Bible quotations and scriptures and stuff like that in it. And this guy, what I'm starting to realize, and this is only like even just up to a couple of weeks ago, this guy was really looking for an answer. Phyllis always said, you know, I've used up my right to chemical-free peace of mind. She I remember her telling me that in the beginning. And I can't fix what's wrong with my life by taking something to fix it, because if I do take something to fix it, that's my higher power. See, there's a difference between faith and belief. I didn't know that either. Like, I believed in God, but my faith was in the bottle. My faith was in what was going to fix it for me. And that's what happened to Dave. You know, and he's dead tonight, and I'm not. And I know that I suffer from the exact same disease that he does. And, you know, what that means is that I have to have a spiritual answer. And all of the rest of this action, you know, action and activity. See, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to begin to put together a life that works. I wish I could tell you I'm free from myself. Believe me, I'm not. I was, you know, I wake up some mornings and my sense of humor does not. And I, you know, I'm a spiritual being with a bad attitude, you know what I mean? I've been told early on that if I wake up in the morning and I'm breathing, I'm a spiritual being. Well, sometimes, I have to work real hard. I have to work real hard. I get up early. I get extra early. I wake up at like 5:15 every morning. And the only reason to get out of bed at that hour is so that I can meet with my higher power, because I need that amount of time. My brain doesn't work like, you know, maybe your brain doesn't work like that either, but I assume that it works better than mine. You know, I think that I'm the one who lives in this head, and it scares me to death some days. You know, there are still times when I realize, I absolutely know that if without this spiritual answer, I'm going to die drunk and there isn't a goddamn thing I can do about it of my own power. But I believe 100% in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love this program more than anything in the world, and more than anything in my life. I want to say one more thing, and this was also from Frank M. that shared this, and it was so perfect, and it helped me so much. He said that, you know, people can come around here for a long time and that they think Alcoholics Anonymous is about drinking, but Alcoholics Anonymous is about establishing a spiritual way of life. It's having had a spiritual experiences as the result of these steps. We try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And he said, Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and fellowship is like the hospital, and the steps and the higher power is like the surgery. And if you're dying from this disease, you can come into this hospital and you can sit here, and I don't care how much you love the people or how nice they are to you here or how wonderful you feel when you're in meetings, if you don't have the surgery, you're going to die from the disease. And I clung to that when I heard it, because I thought, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want, you know, it's not just like I don't want to just do these steps because, like, yeah, I've done the 12 steps. I want to give myself a chance to live. I want to give an opportunity to have the 12 steps change Donna so that I don't have to be who I used to be. See, I get a chance today to be the woman that I hope I'm growing into. And I thank you for being here tonight. I really thank you for letting me share with you. And I love my sobriety. I love this program. Thanks.